Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Sports Performance Radio Show, where you'll be entertained, educated, and motivated by top experts in a variety of fields, including sport, business, and fitness. Your host, Chris Thomas, is a speaker, certified mind performance consultant, personal trainer, sports and remedial massage therapist, and author of 6 Days to a Champion's Mindset. He wants to help you win. To learn about Chris, log on to u2-mindbodyfitness.co.uk. Who's your special guest this week, Chris?
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Sports Performance Radio Show, where we speak to top athletes and those involved in sport about the kind of mental skills needed to succeed. And I'm your host, Chris Thomas. Today we talk to Dr. Robin Jackson. Dr. Jackson's PhD on choking under pressure in self-paced skills led to a specialization in sports psychology. Robin leads the MSc program for sports psychology and has developed a new MSc in sport and exercise psychology for accreditation by the British Psychological Society, the first intake for the program being in September 2009. He worked as psychologist and performance analyst for Great Britain Wheelchair Rugby from 1999 to 2005, spanning 2 Paralympic Games, 3 European Championships and a World Championships. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Chris. Nice to join you.
Thank you for being here. And I've been really looking forward to this topic of choking under pressure in sport. It's something that you see a lot take place in sport, as you well know yourself. So what made you actually focus on this for your PhD?
I think you've hit on it right away, really. It's a fascinating thing that everyone sees all the time in sports. It's incredibly common, and I think even from a very young, early age, I was sort of interested in things like, you know, tennis players who would seemingly serve incredibly well, and then when sort of break point down, would suddenly serve a double fault, and being young and naive, I kind of wondered why that was the case and assumed it was possibly possible to just perform at the same level, you know, so that sort of experience is really replicated across so many different sports that it caught my interest, really.
Talking about the tennis, I'm sorry if you were watching the French Open, I've dragged you away.
Are they still on a rain break?
Well, they've come back now. I can keep you updated if you want, or I can keep it's up
it's
to you.
It's a pretty interesting point in the game.
But if you're interested, then it's 2 sets up to Nadal.
Well, I'm sure your listeners would be, so, you know, I'd hate to deprive the listeners of any updates, so feel free to interrupt when something important happens.
Yeah, I'll keep you posted. Myself, like you, are very interested in, you know, what goes on in an athlete's mind when this situation comes up and when it happens and why it happens. So, talking about choking under pressure, what are the 2 theories of this, and what are the main differences?
Okay, well, there's essentially, as you say, 2 different sort of ways in which people can fail under pressure, and quite a lot of research has gone into the idea that when under pressure, players sort of start thinking about all the technical aspects of what they should do, things that with all the thousands of hours of practice that they've had, they should perform automatically. You know, if we drive a car, after several years, you can hold a conversation with somebody in the passenger seat next to you and perfectly safely. You know, so much of what you do is automatic. But in many different walks of life, it pays to kind of slow down, think things through, and think logically. And the paradox is that motor skills tend to fail when you do that. You know, trying to consciously control a golf swing, for example, there's so many different moving parts and they have to all interact in an incredibly complex way. So trying to sort of do that consciously seems to disrupt performance. So that's a lot of research has gone into that. And the other thing is distraction, being distracted. So the one that typically occurs is, or that you hear about is when people say they just start focusing on the outcome and, you know, suddenly they see the trophy there and they're starting to distract themselves from things that they've done to get to that point. So those are the 2 main theories, really.
I know years ago when I heard this expression, they choked, I always thought it to be that they kind of like given up, or that they sort of like said to themselves, well, you know what, this is too much pressure for me. I just can't deal with this. But it's not that at all, is it, really?
No, not at all. I mean, the irony is that people are almost to qualify as a choke, you kind of need to eliminate that situation when people just tank it. It's situations when people are really, really striving for success. And if anything, you know, trying harder and harder to perform, they often can get worse and worse. So it's certainly not sort of withdrawing effort and, you know, throwing a set in tennis, that sort of thing. That wouldn't be described or defined as a choke.
It's interesting how you spoke about memory and some things that you do consciously, some things that you do unconsciously. And how does this tie in with the portion of when they start to choke under pressure, with the two different types of memory that we have, like the, is it the explicit
more implicit stuff?
It's
an interesting one. I mean, many tasks essentially require a lot of working memory space, which you can think of as like the computer. You know, you've got your working memory and you've got your that is what the computer can do in calculating a whole bunch of bunch of tasks. And some tasks like decision making and thinking strategically, or in academics if you're doing an exam, all those sorts of things take a lot of conscious effort and take up a lot of your what's a fairly limited working memory space or working memory capacity. Motor skills, on the other hand, as I said earlier, you know, if something is automatic and incredibly well drilled, you can perform that with almost no resources taken from working memory. Where that's important is that the type of choking that occurs seems to link into the type of task that's going on. So in sports, if you like, the technical automated skills are more likely to fail if you start thinking about the mechanics of what you do.
Right.
But the more decision-making aspects of skills, or strategizing and, you know, all those kind of conscious thinking processes. So, for example, in golf, that's your planning of how you're going to actually go about, working your way through the hole rather than what you're doing with each individual golf swing. Those ones tend to be more susceptible to failure because of distraction, or, you know, having anxious thoughts that distract you from thinking clearly. So that's sort of come out quite well in the research, really, is that difference between the types of tasks and then how that affects ways in which people will fail under pressure.
Okay, I mean, related to that, in your opinion, what kinds of, what aspects of pressure situations can lead to this distraction or this explicit monitoring, as you called it? So what types of...
I'd sort of come back to the distinction between the tasks, really. I think it's rather than, say, the different aspects of pressure, and I guess, you know, even in sort of a term that people feel they understand quite well, I think you've got different aspects to that. So you've got an objective form of pressure, so having a penalty kick to win a penalty shootout, or a penalty kick not to lose a penalty shootout, you know, that objectively is a high-pressure situation.
Yeah.
But then you have the individual's perception of that situation. So if you perceive you have the skills to do it, you're very good at controlling your emotions under pressure, all those sorts of things, then your perceptions of that pressure might be very different from someone who doesn't feel so in control of that kind of situation. So I think it's more about the nature of the task. But a whole host of different things feed into pressure, if that's where you're going with it. And that can be expectations quite often of others and the press and the media and all those sorts of things, but also an individual's expectations. So different things will feed into potentially enhancing or increasing a perception of pressure, but the type of task is really key in terms of the way a skill might break down.
Okay, that's interesting. What's the difference between someone who chokes and one who panics? Is there a difference?
panicking, if you like, that kind of loss of emotional control is one form of choking, or one way of choking. So, you know, people talk about the ability to self-regulate. So that's controlling your emotions, your thoughts, and your behaviors in whatever situation. So, you know, a component of that is clearly keeping your emotions in check, and whether that's the way you interpret your nerves, or the way you respond to a bad refereeing decision, you know, whatever that might be, then that's an aspect of being able to self-regulate. When that breaks down, then it might be loss of emotional control, and you respond badly to somebody else tackling you badly or something. Or it could be that you start thinking too much about the mechanics, or it could be that you start worrying and that influences your decision making. You know, so that's I suppose you could call that, you know, a catch-all term for what's going on. When that emotional control breaks down, or your ability to self-regulate breaks down, then the variety of means that will make your performance worse.
And I suppose that's it changes for every sport, because let's say a team sport, we have, you know, 5 to 11, depending on what sport you're playing. You have different members on the team. Each individual has the opportunity to, just calm down, to self-regulate their own emotions individually. But when it's maybe like a solo sport, like tennis or golf, let's take tennis, for instance, where things are moving at a quicker pace. It's quite difficult to do that, isn't it?
It certainly puts the emphasis on the individual, and so you could argue you've got a bit more of a safety net within a team, in that if you're breaking down, you've got other teammates to kind of hopefully help you snap back into a good level of performance. But you're right under the microscope with those individual skills, so that could be an individual sport like tennis, but also within a team sport, often it comes down to individuals. Free throws in basketball, goal kicks in rugby, and penalty shootouts in football. So, you know, I think that's an interesting point you raise about that team versus individual thing.
I think sometimes in the team sports, like for instance, like in football, where you have a striker who a lot is expected of. And if they fail and they choke, that has obviously a massive impact on the rest of the team, which then that may, if you like, infiltrate the rest of the team. So the whole team then starts to choke under the pressure. And I think that's what sometimes you see in sport, in team sports, where it just filters through to the rest of the players. Is that something you would agree with, or?
Yeah, I don't know if any sort of research has been done on that, but certainly just anecdotally, it does seem that you get that kind of thing. I mean, with teams who are a long way clear in the Premiership, for example, and suddenly find it much more difficult to win matches, the team as a whole looks to lack self-confidence, team cohesion starts to break down, decision-making tends to get poorer, and things that just seem to sort of flow effortlessly previously suddenly start failing. We looked a little bit at decision making in team sports, and found that people who tended to go over poor decisions they've made in the past, which we call rumination, they tended to be rated as more likely to make poor decisions under pressure. So again, it seems as if similar processes might be at play even within a team sport.
It's such a difficult thing, though, isn't it, for especially when you're playing at such a high level, elite level, where to get something out of your mind, a poor decision, that's gone against you. And you see it quite a lot in, I refer to tennis because I like tennis myself. But you see that quite a lot in tennis when there's a bad call. And some players are able to overcome that and get rid of it, we think. And some players just seem to say to themselves, well, you know what, next point. Let's just focus on here and now, the present, and play each point as best as I can. But it's really quite a difficult thing to do, I would imagine, at such
a
high...
Well, it's a skill. Absolutely right. Yeah, it is a skill. And I think, I suppose not that long ago, sports psychology was looked on as a bit of kind of mysterious thing, if you like. But some of those, but everyone would accept that the mental side of sports is absolutely huge. So those sorts of things, and learning to be able to control your emotions in that sort of situation is just a typical part of what sports psychologists will try and do. I think, fortunately, the line calls are less of an issue these days with Hawkeye. But
yeah.
But certainly other things, you know, and totally speculating here, but if you just simply look at players' behaviours, certain players seem to go into ruts more than others. And, you know, you could look at Andy Murray, for example, who seems to get very, very frustrated on court and start looking to his... you know, where his coaches
yes.
are,
yeah.
and his game sort of changes quite rapidly sometimes when things just aren't quite going his way, and it's an interesting one to see that and to think what he might do to try and improve. Quite a tricky one.
Yeah. And I don't intend to do like a character assassination here, but as you mentioned, Andy Murray. One thing I noticed last week, I'm just wondering whether this is part of choking under the pressure. There was lots of talk about he having a bad back, and I don't know whether he was doing this deliberately to put the other person off, or whether he was choking under the pressure. Because every time, obviously, he missed a shot, he would hold his back and start walking, you know, start limping, and that actually didn't improve his game. It made it slightly go downhill slightly. So could that be classed as a type of choking, when you start to imagine, not imagine things, but perhaps escalate things in your mind that aren't really there or aren't really a problem?
Well, the whether or not something is choking, I guess, comes down to the stats on things. So irrespective of whatever reason a performer might give for not doing so well, then the proof of whether it's a choke or not really comes down to the stats. So if his you know, if his number of unforced errors goes up dramatically, for example, then and there's no rational explanation for it, then fair enough, you could argue that's choking. Now, one way to try and cover that up, if you like, is to point to an injury and say, yeah, well, normally things would be fine, but I've got this problem, and therefore that's why my performance was at a lower level. I'm not remotely saying that's what was happening with Murray. It sounded fairly convincing that, you know, the issues he had.
Yeah.
But again, yeah, I mean, if you're going to make attributions about, you know, causes of success and failure, then something very well established to kind of keep your sense of self-worth is when you don't do so well, you point to external factors rather than your own individual lack of ability or lack of effort or something, you know. So an injury or a referee making a dodgy call or whatever, those things are pretty commonly seen in sports.
We touched on this a bit earlier about the pressure of being watched by others and how that can make a person choke. So how does that perhaps induce choking, being watched by family, friends, coach, TV?
It's a really interesting one. This research done back in the 80s by a guy called Roy Baumeister came up with some fascinating data on what happened in the in key deciding matches of basketball playoffs and baseball playoffs. And what he found was that the team playing at home, when they were on the verge of winning, suddenly performed much worse. and so normally, as you'd be well aware, there's a home field advantage. And what he found was that when on the verge of being successful, this turned almost into a home field disadvantage. And what was fascinating about that research is that it was big headlines about it in the States. And once it had come out, almost the pressure switched. So the expectation then became that the home team was going to lose because it was a decider and everyone knew about this research. And what happened then, there's a whole string of wins for the home team. So it's quite an interesting sort of thing. Now, whether or not that was because that research was publicized so highly, I don't know. Overall, the home field advantage is very strong and the evidence is good, and that's brilliant with London 2012 around the corner.
Right.
But to get back to your question about what it is about an audience, it really comes down to expectations again. And performing in front of people who have possibly invested a lot in you, whether that's a coach or parents or whatever, your desire to succeed is that much higher. And in my view, the particularly tricky situation is when there's a mismatch between the audience's expectations and the player's expectations. So if somebody watching, for example, perceives a 5-foot putt in golf to be absolutely routine, or football penalty shootouts, everyone assumes the kicker should score. And objectively, even, it's not as simple as that. Even penalty shootouts, you get 3 out of 4 are scored on average, 75%. So it's not as easy as maybe it's made out to be. So that sort of scenario creates, or potentially creates, a mismatch between what the audience expect to happen and what maybe the confidence of a performer might have.
I think go ahead.
No, I was just going to, so an example, maybe over the years, that's really interesting, really good of this kind of mismatch, is the perennial expectation that England are going to win the World Cup or the European Championships or whatever. Yeah. You know, the expectations have always been absolutely enormous going in.
Yeah.
And objectively, we won nothing since '66. So, you know, if there's a huge mismatch there. It's that makes things quite tricky.
I think it is just so amazing about that example that you gave in America, how it... it changes the visitor's perspective. That just a piece of research like that can just change the whole psychology of the sport, and it does go to
absolutely
show how perhaps susceptible to influence we are when we read something like that. Do you know what I mean? Because if you are the away team and you read that, you go in with a different mindset totally, and it will affect you and the home team, which is just amazing. So I guess
it is all about those expectations again. Suddenly the expectations have switched around wholesale. I mean, I think another great example is Greg Norman when on the eve of the final round of the Masters in, I think it was 97, and he was leading by 6 shots, I think it was, going into that final round. And the bookmakers had stopped taking bets on who'd win.
Mm-hmm.
It was an absolute cast. Everyone had put his name on the trophy. And anyone who's played golf knows that 6 shots can go incredibly quickly.
Right.
So the mismatch, if you like, there between somebody assuming you just need to turn up to win it, and when the guy closest to you is Nick Faldo, who goes on to shoot 5 under for that final round, suddenly you've got to go out there and shoot, you know, par to win the tournament. That's I think
heavy on.
I certainly wouldn't want to blame the media, but they certainly they have a role in everything in terms of setting that level of expectations.
Well. How would you suggest athletes control their emotions during crunch times? Then, when they feel that pressure coming on, would there be tips that you would give someone to help them just keep it under control as much as they can?
Incredibly difficult to generalize about that, but if we come back to that kind of model about thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, then all three of those things can influence each other. So depending on whatever the skill might be, making sure you're thinking clearly beforehand is critical, and managing those expectations and interpreting them in a way that's favorable or helpful to you is really key. If the press are building up the expectations, then you want to try and downplay those as much as you can, or at least make them more realistic. And the other side of that equation is to build up your own personal expectations and to not be seen to be backing away from the challenge, if you like, but actually embracing it.
Right.
I don't want to go bang on about penalty shootouts, but I think England have had a culture of avoidance over decades now, right from the sort of manager's level, where several managers kept on saying how we couldn't practice penalty shootouts because you couldn't recreate the pressure situation.
Yep.
Can you imagine somebody in the military saying, well, we're not going to rehearse or practice these things because we can't recreate the pressure of a battle scene. You know, it's incredibly short-sighted thinking, really.
Yeah.
But anyway, that thought side is really, really critical. In certain skills, having a very consistent pre-shot routine is incredibly helpful at getting you to feel in control of the situation. Mm. And then, depending on the nature of the task, you might want to slow down, take a step back, and think things through when you feel like you're losing control, if you have time to do that. So that's the kind of working memory intensive stuff. Or you need tricks to try and let yourself perform effortlessly and fluently if it's the likes of a golf swing that needs to be, you know, you need to let go of conscious control almost. So it's a tricky one to give general things, but just trying to get a grip of any or all of the thoughts, emotions and behaviors and rehearsing those things will be incredibly helpful.
Okay, great.
And I think the English Institute of Sport have been doing a lot of work at trying to create pressure situations and make that just a regular feature of practice so that that becomes the norm. And clearly the difference then in going to the Olympics or whatever it might be is that much reduced. It's not eliminated. The Olympics you can't recreate, just like a penalty shootout.
Exactly.
But there's a lot of evidence that practicing under some pressure can help you perform when it really counts.
Yeah, I think in basketball, they have people in the stand when like someone's doing a free throw. They have someone, a group of people standing behind the basket with those, I don't know what they are. They're like white bottles or something.
They hold up. Things, aren't they?
Yeah. And they have those.
Stuff.
Yeah. And they're shaking them and shouting, and so they can recreate a part of what it would be like to do a free throw in those conditions. So that must help or go a great way.
I think you're right. It could help. I just wonder just how distracting performers find that, because it's almost, when so many people do it, it's almost like white noise. And that is sort of less distracting. It's just not so much of an issue. If one person suddenly did it when everyone was dead still, that might be more distracting.
Well, that's a trick.
I'll tell you what. I used to work at University of Glamorgan, and the local rugby club down there was Pontypridd, and they seemed very, very clever at putting off kickers. So the crowd would go very, very quiet when the away team kicker was setting up their kick. And then they suddenly sort of, I don't know, question their parenthood or shout out something just as the guy was beginning his run-up, rather than just have a kind of permanent white noise of booing.
Yeah.
And they seem to have quite a lot of success from what I saw. I'd argue that's probably a slightly better strategy, to be honest. Don't want to give people ideas, but, you know.
Yeah. Have one person in the whole of the Olympic Stadium.
But I think there is a point about just that white noise effect. When everyone's booing, I think kickers, goal kickers or whoever it might be, they can find that easier to block out than if there's a bunch of different stuff going on.
Well, this has been really, really interesting. We've just got a little bit of time left for the remainder of the show, and I just want to ask you very quickly, if you could briefly describe what skill failure is, if we haven't discussed it already, and how does it contribute to choking?
Well, it is that's kind of part of the definition of choking, if you like. So, it's skill failure when you're most motivated to succeed, really. And without getting too technical into that, to be sensible term that we can use scientifically, you need to kind of statistically analyze stuff. So there is a random variation in performance that happens. Golfers have bad rounds, football penalty kicks are missed, all that kind of thing. And the moment somebody hits a poor kick in a pressure situation, the press jump all over it and say that was a choke. But those things go on all the time. So for us to kind of actually study that, we need to show that certain people are more, or certain situations are more prone to choking than others. And the example I give of that, Shaquille O'Neal, he's not a great basketball free thrower, around 50-odd percent, I think, last time I checked. But in one championship game, he was successful with 0 from 8 free throw attempts. And you can just do your sums on that and work out that the chances of that happening are incredibly low, even for a 50% free throw shooter. So, you know, so when we're looking at it scientifically, we can say, okay, that there's something going on there.
Yeah.
Or on a one-off situation, somebody can miss by so far, you know, that it's out of the realms of what you normally expect. So Jan and Ivotna back in the day, when final against Steffi Graf, you know, suddenly she was hitting volleys that were going way out and first serves that were going over the baseline, you know. So there's different ways of looking at it, but skill failure is synonymous with choking, really.
Well, Robin, this has been just really insightful, and like I said, I was so looking forward to discussing this, and I've really talked about some key issues about choking under pressure and what it actually means and how perhaps there's ways of overcoming it and dealing with it, controlling the emotions and controlling the controllable, I always say.
Absolutely, that's a very good tip.
So it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. I wish we could talk more, and perhaps you can come on again onto the show and later date, and we can talk a bit more about this and other topics. That would be fantastic.
That's great. Well, thanks for the invitation, Chris. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. So today we were talking to Dr. Robin Jatson, who wrote a PhD on choking under pressure in self-paced skills, which led to a specialization in sports psychology. And choking under pressure is such a key issue in sport, and we're so glad that we were able to talk about this topic. And we thank Dr. Robin again for coming onto the show and sharing his thoughts with us.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Great. Thank you very much. You've been listening to the Sports Performance Show. We'll speak to you at another date. Thank you and goodbye.